afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And I welcome you to call in if you'd like to today if you have questions about the Bible, about Christianity, about anything related to your own spiritual life and spiritual journey, or if you have a difference of opinion from the host and would like to register a difference, a balanced comment with your other side of the story perhaps, feel free to give me a call. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. I just want to say before I start going to these calls that tonight, being Monday night, we have a Bible study that I teach each Monday night in Salinas on the book of 2 Peter. That's each Monday night at 7 o'clock. And that's tonight at 7 o'clock. It's in a home. And if you have been there before, then you know where it is, and we just want to remind you that it's there. If you have never been there before and would like directions, you can call Larry at this number. It's area code 831-442-8143. That's 442-8143. If you'd like to come on out and see us tonight in Salinas, 7 o'clock, our regular weekly Bible study in Salinas. Let's talk to Rashad, who's calling from Elmont, New York, first of all, today. Hi, Rashad. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey, how you doing, Steve?
Good, thanks.
So I want to make a comment and then ask a question, which I'll take off the air.
Okay.
The comment is basically, remember the last time I called, I told you that that they found a tumor in my back?
Yes. How'd that turn out?
Well, I had surgery on the 18th of January, which they removed the tumor.
Uh-huh.
It was the size of two golf balls put together.
That's pretty uncomfortable. Was it benign or was it malignant?
It was benign. Thank God. The kind of tumor that I had was it's called a schwannoma, and it's 98% of the time it's benign. So, you know, I happen to fall into that 98% of the 90th percentile.
Praise the Lord.
I was one of the lucky ones.
We're glad to hear that, brother.
Yeah, I'm glad that you appreciate that, and I thank you for your prayers that you did. I was in the hospital for about 21 days. Like,
wow.
actually literally 21 days. I was there from the 18th of January through the 8th of February. And including that first surgery, I ended up having two others. So I did. It was three surgeries and one bedside procedure.
Wow.
The whole experience was interesting because you know sometimes you wonder if people actually people really care about you and all that.
Uh-huh.
But I saw that people really do care about me, and like people who didn't even actually visit me in the hospital visited me. And, making sure I was okay, bringing me food, bringing me different stuff, the different things like that. So, really opened my eyes that people actually do care about me. And it made me feel better,
So are you back to work now?
Not yet. I won't be back to work for a while because the surgery, the surgery took a lot out of me. So, I can't really lift heavy objects. And, I get tired a lot.
Well, then what I want to know, Rashad, is who's guarding and keeping safe the streets of Elmont, New York?
Well, the rest of the cops that are out there,
Okay, they can do without you for a little while? Okay.
Yeah, they can do without me for a little while, so, it's all good.
I thought maybe all the criminals, they were having a field day when you were out of commission.
I bet they were.
well, I'm glad things went well with your surgery. You had a question too?
Say again?
You had a question as well.
Oh, yes, I had a question too. As far as when Jesus returns and and changes everything, gives us our immortal bodies and all that. I'm wondering about something when it comes to that, and I have other questions regarding the when he returns. As far as that, do you think that we're going to still need to eat, or are we just going to be sustained without having to eat food to continue on living?
Now, what do you mean have to eat? Don't you want to eat?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I would want to eat, but I'm just wondering if it's going to be necessary anymore.
I can't say for sure, but I will say that when Jesus rose from the dead in a glorified body, he did eat. He ate with his disciples more than once. And, what seems like the first time he did it, it might have been in order to prove to them that he was physically raised. But then he had breakfast with them by the Sea of Galilee on another occasion in John chapter 21. So I think that he ate probably regularly. In the book of Revelation, it says that the tree of life is growing in the New Jerusalem, and it produces its fruits 12 times a year, which suggests that, you know, probably someone's eating that fruit. And so I believe that eating will be a part of our existence.
All right. And do you think that the sun is still going to be around? Because isn't there some scripture that says something about Jesus shining so brightly that we won't need the sun or something like to that effect?
Well, yeah. In Revelation 21, it says that the city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine in it because the glory of God and of the Lamb is its light. And that might be symbolic, or it might be literal. I guess we'll have to wait and see.
All right. And the third and final part of that is as far as animals that eat meat to these days, do you think they still do the same thing once everything is renewed?
Well, I can't really say. I don't know if we'll be killing and eating animals in the new earth, or if things will be more copacetic between animals and man, a little bit like before the fall. I mean, certainly the situation after Jesus comes back is supposed to be a restoration of things to a large extent the way they were before the fall. Whether they'll be exactly the same, I don't know. So, I mean, if you're a meat lover, you know, you might think, well, I'm not sure I want to go there if we're not eating meat. But actually, there's not supposed to be any sea there anymore either. So a lot of surfers are not going to want to be there. And then, of course, there's no marriage there either. So that makes a lot of people unhappy. But actually, some of those descriptions, I'm sure, are symbolic. And we can't really be sure exactly what the nature of it will be. I do believe, though, that if it sounds like some of our favorite enjoyments are not going to be there, I can guarantee you no one's going to be disappointed who makes it there.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Like Chuck Smith used to say, he loved to surf. And he'd say, you know, he said he was disappointed to hear there would be no sea in the new earth. Because he loved to surf, but he said, but there's not going to be surfing in hell either.
Yeah, Luke, not at all.
All right, well, is that what you wanted to know?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know. Thank you so much for your answers.
All right, welcome back to Good Health, and we look forward to hearing from you some more.
All right, Steve, I definitely will be calling more in the future.
All right, God bless you.
God bless you.
Bye-bye. All right, we're going to talk next to Homer, calling from Brownsville, Oregon. Homer, welcome to The Narrow Path, and thanks for calling. Good to hear from you again.
You too. Hey, I got a two-part question here, I guess. First, to clarify your view on something, and then I want to ask you about the practical application.
Okay.
Okay, first, as I understand your view regarding Paul's instruction that he did not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man, as I understand your view, you believe that a woman can teach or preach as long as she is under submission or under authority of the elders, or maybe you might want to clarify that first.
Well, yeah, I don't know much about the under the authority of the elders. I mean, I think that everyone who speaks up should be under whatever authority the leaders of the church possess. Whether male or female people speak up, I think that they should be under the authority of whatever legitimate authority exists in the church. Women in particular, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11, should be under the authority of their husband if they're married women. But there's never any reference to anyone being under the authority of the elders when they speak up in the church. But I would think that that would go without saying, that if the elders truly are the ones who are given oversight over the church meeting, then presumably everything that's conducted in the meeting would be under their oversight.
Okay, then if women can speak the same as men can speak, then what's Paul's point? He must have meant there was some difference when he gave this teaching or command.
So well, my understanding is he's talking about eldership. Talking about being or not being elders.
Uh-huh.
And when he says he does not permit a woman to teach or have authority over a man, my understanding is those are the things elders did.
Uh-huh.
They teach and they have authority over the church. And, of course, that statement is made in 1 Timothy chapter 2 just immediately prior to Paul giving the qualifications for elders.
Mm-hmm.
So my thought is that Paul's concern at that point in his correspondence with Timothy is to inform Timothy about the things that qualify and disqualify a person for a position in eldership.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, since that's the context, my impression is that that's what he's saying about women when he says he doesn't want them to teach or have authority over men, that is, over the general congregation, which includes men. That would be part of the whole section where he's talking about qualifications for elders, I think.
Mm-hmm. But then he would be sort of redundant when he says the elder must be the husband of one wife, because right there he would rule out women.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, there'd be a little bit of redundancy, but not entirely, because even once he's ruled out women for that position, he now has to rule out a great number of men. And so
right.
In saying he must be the husband of one wife, he's not trying to reestablish the point that it can't be a woman, although, of course, his statement makes it clear that a woman cannot be a husband of one wife. So obviously Paul is thinking of women not as able to qualify. But his point in making that is not simply to be redundant. In other words, he didn't just say an elder must be a husband, not a wife.
Mm-hmm.
If he said that would be redundant. Mm-hmm. But if he said it has to be the husband of one wife, it means that, okay, now we've ruled out women for that position. Now we're ruling out a lot of men, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, men who are not the husbands of one wife.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I got your position.
Okay, yeah. And what is your thought, Homer? I don't know if I remember you ever expressing it. do you think women should not teach at all in the church, or what?
No, I'm a little unsure on that.
Uh-huh.
Just where the boundaries Paul intended lie.
Yeah.
I have the book, you've mentioned it before, by, it's titled Women in the Church by, I don't know how you pronounce his name, Kostenberger or something like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's Schreiner, and I just read a little bit in it, but...
It's a pretty scholarly work.
Pardon?
It's a good scholarly work, I think.
Yeah, I think it's, from what I've heard, it's one of the highest recommended on the subject, and I've been digging into that book about Sunday for quite some time, and that's quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
now, on the woman's issue, another book I think is really good is the one that's edited by John Piper and Wayne Grudem,
uh-huh.
called Restoring Biblical Manhood and Womanhood.
Uh-huh.
It's a compendium of articles and chapters written by a number of scholars, both male and female, but all from the same point of view.
Uh-huh.
And that is what we might call the traditional view,
mm-hmm.
about the roles of women.
Well, by the way, in that book on Sunday, that Willie Rohrdorf and his comments on the offering they were taking for the saints at Jerusalem when he
uh-huh.
told them to lay by and store on the first day of the week.
Yeah.
He said something very interesting there I hadn't heard. He said that the instruction is actually to lay it by yourself, meaning at home.
Right.
Before you come to church. And he takes that as strong evidence that there was a regular offering being taken every Sunday, and that the reason Paul instructed them to set that money aside at home was that he didn't want them to get it mixed in with a regular offering, which usually apparently went out almost immediately to help other people, you know.
Yeah, you know, that's assuming some things that I don't necessarily assume when I read 1 Corinthians 16:2 where Paul said that on the first day of the week he wants everyone to lay by himself some portion to be given to be given to the church in Jerusalem, which Paul and his companions would pick up when they arrived and carry. A lot of people, because Paul mentions the first day of the week, simply assume that he's referring to a practice of Christians meeting on the first day of the week, that is Sunday. And while I don't have any problem believing that Christians may have met on the first day of the week, maybe even regularly, I don't think that verse could establish it. He doesn't say anything about church. He doesn't say anything about gathering. He doesn't say anything about a meeting. He just says on the first day of the week, which, of course, would be the day after the Sabbath day. And one could argue that what he's saying is you can't do this on the Sabbath. You can't, you know, after you've gotten your Sabbath passed and you've got a fresh week started, you need to take a portion of whatever came, you know, whatever you got the previous week and put it aside. But what I don't know why he said the first day of the week, but, you know, some people just assume, well, there were Christian meetings on the first day of the week, so it's talking about taking an offering on Sunday. But there's certainly nothing in the verse that would give that impression.
Yeah. Well, one thing he did point out was, in regard to that, is that Paul could have picked any day of the week, and he picked Sunday.
Yeah. And yeah, and he may have done it because they were meeting on Sundays. It's entirely possible. Or he may have done it because it was the day after the Sabbath, and they, you know, it's the start of a new business week.
Right. And shortly afterward, too, he points out that about that time, the Christians had named Sunday as the Lord's Day, and it was the only day that they gave a name to.
Yeah, that's it. I know they did. I know they did. At least we know they did in the Didache, which is not very long after the writing of the New Testament. And, of course, on the book of Revelation, we have John using the term the Lord's Day, which might be, it might be that he's using it the way that the Christians later did, meaning Sunday.
Right.
Some people say it should be translated the day of the Lord. But anyway, that's another issue. The point I would make is I don't know if they were calling Sunday the Lord's Day when Paul wrote Corinthians, which was much earlier than Revelation, probably, at least a decade or more earlier, because it seems like he would have said, on the Lord's Day, set aside something by you, if that's the way they were speaking of it, like we would say Sunday or whatever.
Yeah.
But he said on the first day of the week, which makes me think at least it's at least as possible that he's referring to that day because it is the beginning of a business week. And because, remember, there's a principle in the Old Testament and the New that you give the Lord the first fruits. You give the Lord the first of your of everything. You put God first in all things. And Paul might be saying, now that you've got a business week starting, do your business with God first, you know, before you go about your week to make your money for you. Make sure you put aside something for God.
Weren't all the workers back at that time paid every day at the end of the day?
Yes.
I think they were. So.
At least in Israel they were. I don't know about Corinth. I don't know about Greece, right. But yeah, in Israel they were.
Anyway, he's pretty highly thought of. I ran onto some comments by Everett Ferguson praising his work. So.
All right. Well, good. Good.
All right. I'll catch you later, Steve.
Well, Homer, it's great to hear from you.
You too. God bless.
God bless you too.
Bye
now. All right. Our next call is from Brad in Paradise, California. Hi, Brad. Good to hear from you again.
Thank you. It's good to talk to you again. Hey, I've got a two-part question. As long as we're talking about Titus and Paul's instruction, when he does say husband of one wife, I just like your views on that, how that would pertain to divorced men today. And also when we talk then from elders to deacons about deacons being women in the church.
Well, there were women deacons, that's for sure. I mean, Paul does talk about female deacons, unless he's referring to the deacons' wives. There's some dispute in 1 Timothy chapter 3 when he uses the term the women in the context where he's talking about qualifications for deacons. There are some who've wondered whether he means female deacons or the wives of deacons. But we know there were female diaconess. Diaconess is the Greek word for deacon, but it's also the Greek word for a servant. And we know that Phoebe, for example, in the opening verses of Romans 16, was referred to as a deacon in the feminine form. The word diaconess in the female is referred to her. So, but there's a question there, of course, whether he's using the word diaconess to mean the office of a deacon or simply a servant, since that's what the word means. You know, she might simply be being referred to a faithful servant of the Lord, whether she held office as a deaconess or not. We can't say, though I would certainly have no reason to object to it.
Well,
everyone,
a full deacon board that's all female.
Well, I don't know about a full deacon board that's all female, but I would say that since a deacon is simply a servant of the church, and as far as we know, they had no leadership roles in the church except to wait on tables and distribute things. I mean, they were serving the practical needs of the church, as frankly everyone ought to be prepared to do. You know,
elders are.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of times in some churches, deacons have the role of elders, but that's, the word deacon just means a servant. An elder is referring to the people who actually did lead the church, and that was a different thing. We don't read of any female elders, but we do read of female deacons, apparently. Now, as far as the husband of one wife, whether that excludes divorced men, many people feel that it does. There are many who feel that when Paul said a bishop must be the elder of the husband of one wife, he means in one's lifetime, one can only have been married one time. And therefore, if a person was divorced, no matter how legitimately, and then remarried, well, then he would not be qualified because he's been the husband of more than one wife in his lifetime. And so their assumption is that a man who's had more than one wife in his lifetime does not qualify, and that's what Paul is saying. Well, if Paul is saying that, then, of course, Paul is also excluding a man who's been widowed and remarried because he also has had more than one wife in his lifetime. And it's hard to imagine why Paul would wish to exclude somebody who'd been widowed and remarried, since there wouldn't be any stigma attached to that at all. No one would ever blame him for his widowhood, though some people might blame him for being divorced. So my impression is that what Paul's saying is, and certainly the Greek can be rendered this way, since the word wife is the generic word for a woman, and the word husband is the generic word for a man in the Greek. Some would say instead of husband of one wife, it should be translated a one-woman man. That is, a man of one woman.
Mm-hmm.
And what that would be saying is monogamous. He's a monogamous man. He doesn't have more than one wife, and he doesn't have more than one woman. He's got only a wife and no other women in his life. So that it'd be saying he's not a womanizer. He's a faithful husband. He's a man of one woman, not a man who, you know, has other ladies on the side. And, by the way, one might say, well, that goes without saying, doesn't it? Apparently not. There's elders in churches today who have women on the side besides their wives. They shouldn't. But, I mean, you do find that to be a problem. And so Paul could easily be saying, make sure that the man you choose, being a married man, should be a faithful married man, not a womanizer, not a man who has additional women besides his wife, because there probably were people sneaking into the church and, you know, secretly doing that kind of thing. So he could simply say a faithful husband, a one-woman man. And that would not mean that he must have only had one woman in his lifetime, because if he had legitimately had a previous marriage that ended legitimately, either his wife had died or there had been a legitimate, biblically grounded divorce, and he had remarried, well, he could still be a one-woman man. For example, I've had more than one wife. I don't have a wife now, but when I had my last wife, I was a one-woman man. I mean, I never had any other women on the side. And therefore, one could argue that I was the husband of one wife. I've never been the husband of more than one wife at a time. And that's what some people feel that Paul is saying. Now, since I've never really wanted to be an elder of a church anyway, it doesn't really matter to me about my circumstances. But if I were to just objectively look at what Paul said, and I was considering a man who had had more than one wife legitimately, I don't know that I could use Paul's statement as a means to exclude him from being an elder.
Mm-hmm. How would you look at that? Just in general, Todd, this brings up another question. Looking at that first at face value, would you say he's looking at a family man? He's not looking at a single man.
Yes, it does seem to be that way, which means Paul would apparently exclude himself
mm-hmm.
even from being an elder of the church because he was not a family man. Because as you look at 1 Timothy 3, it makes it very clear. It says He has to be one who has managed his own household well. And it says, because if he can't manage his own household, how can he lead the church?
Okay.
How can he take care of the church? So it seems like he's saying the management of a family and a household is the proving ground for a man to show that he has what it takes to manage a family, like the church. The church is a family.
Well, that's where I was going. I think that's a beautiful way of looking at it, because then you get that overview of him being, you know, of actually having to manage a family, in that the church is that way, and that brings up all the qualifications and characteristics you'd like to see that if they'd be successful at doing that, or
following
the Bible.
That also removes any possibility of people saying Paul was discriminating against women by not letting them be elders, because the qualifications he gave excluded himself as well as them.
Mm-hmm.
Was he discriminating against himself? I mean, obviously, Paul was giving qualifications that would disqualify not only women, but most men, including himself. So there was a very narrow range of circumstances that Paul felt a man's life should fall into in order to qualify him to be a leader of the church. If a person didn't fall into that narrow range, then presumably Paul didn't want him to be one of the leaders of the church.
Yes, but he's talking about being a leader by example, not being a leader by governing.
Well, see, that's it. I mean, sometimes elders were officially appointed, and they did have some kind of responsibility, but the responsibility was to provide leadership as a service rather than to exercise dominion as a person who might be like a CEO of a corporation or a board of directors would do. The elders were simply to provide spiritual leadership, and the biggest part of that is in their example. And that's the smaller part is in what they verbally teach. And that's why Paul, when he gave the qualifications for an elder, gave several verses long list of qualifications. Only once does he mention they have to be able to teach. The rest of it is the example of their family life and of their character.
Do you have a few minutes? Can I take this a little farther?
I could take another question from you, sure.
Well, I have to take that a little bit farther.
Okay.
You're mentioning there about because of elders. How do you see in a church, especially, well, we're talking today, of course, as far as trustees of a church, you know, different offices of a church that wouldn't be elder, of having those being the same people?
Now say that again. Okay,
let me ask it the way I have it. We have our church.
Okay.
The elders are the trustees of the church.
Okay.
The board of directors of the church, and they're also the elders of the church.
You mean they are called trustees, but they're really elders?
No, they are actually trustees. I mean, they are the ones who sign the papers and do those kind of things. And, yes, they are the elders also.
Yeah, as long as you have corporate business for the church to do, there has to be somebody who can sign the paperwork. You know, if you're a corporation of any kind, whether you're a 501c3 or even a for-profit corporation, no matter what kind of corporation you are, if the group of people owns property jointly and so forth in this country, I don't know any way to do that without having a corporation. And you can't have a corporation without having officers who sign the papers. And so, yeah, I would expect the elders of an organized church to be the ones who are the trustees. And in other words, I would not expect there to be one group of men who are the trustees and a different group who are the elders.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
It does, as we do, break down the meeting into different areas, because there's obviously the business, as you would say, the business is that type of business that happens, whether you're fighting a bar, trying to go in next door, or do these kind of things that are legal, and then coming into a state of saying, okay, this is elder business. I mean, it's been tough for us to see that difference sometimes. Sometimes it's like the elders would say, well, I'd like to get out of the business side of this. I just want to, you know, I just want to serve it. I'm fine with being over the spiritual maturity of my church and then helping them grow that way, but that's not what I signed up for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to kind of split. I would agree that we don't have them, and we have a chairman of the board that's also the CEO, the trustee, that, you know, all the way down that line, but it seems to be something that's just two different hats to wear, but it comes under the same kind of, responsibilities.
Yeah, well, it depends on what kind of business the trustees are doing. I guess, now that I think about it, the trustees might do more of the work that would be properly the deacon's work. I mean, if the trustees are primarily people who are, filing the papers with the government and making sure the taxes or the tax forms are filed and making sure the real estate is, the payments are being made or whatever, and that zoning is properly. I mean, those would be probably the kind of things that deacons would do. I guess I hadn't thought when I spoke a moment ago about what trustees really do. But it may be that trustees are more along the lines of deacons.
Mm-hmm.
See, I've never really been very, I never had much of a business head. I don't think about business very often.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it.
Okay, Brad. Thanks for your call.
You too.
Bye now. You too. All right. We'll talk next to Larry from Sterling, Virginia. We also have a line open for you at 1-800-438-5090. I want to remind our Salinas listeners that we have a Monday night meeting each Monday night in Salinas in a home at 7 o'clock. And if you'd like directions to that meeting, you can call Larry at 442-8143. That's 442-8143 if you'd like to get directions to this meeting tonight in Salinas at 7 o'clock. And just because we've had so many calls here, I haven't had time to make many announcements. I do want to quickly make this announcement, and that is that if you are interested in a summer 10-week program where I will be teaching through the entire first five books of the Old Testament, as well as the book of Job and the book of Mark, in 10 weeks, an intensive live-in course. This is going to be held in Seattle. And it costs almost nothing. The Narrow Path and myself will receive no money from it. All it will cost is the money that we pay to Youth with a Mission for renting us rooms and a classroom and providing meals for our students. Now, this is not a Youth with a Mission school. It's a Great Commission school, which is a school I run. I'm not in YWAM. But I'm friends with YWAM, and we're going to be renting facilities, and YWAM's going to be serving our students three meals a day. And you know what they're charging us? $20 a day, room and board. Three meals a day, plus a sleeping room, plus classroom, $20 a day. For 10 weeks, it comes out to like $1,400 for 10 weeks, and that's the whole cost, $1,400 if you want to live in a school this summer, be fed spiritually and physically, and go through a big chunk of the Bible, verse by verse, with yours truly. That's called the Great Commission School. It's going to be happening this summer in the Seattle area. Now, you can find information about that, details, by going to our website, which is thenarrowpath.com, thenarrowpath.com, and you'll find prominently displayed a link to the new Great Commission School. If you click there, you'll find out just about everything you would want to know about that. And I wanted just to say this. We've got a limited enrollment. We're not going to take more than 12 students. We're going to keep it to 12 or less. And this is going to be in Seattle. Now, there's a corollary to this. Starting March 1st, that's what, a week from now or so? Just a little over a week from now. The Narrow Path is going to be broadcast in Seattle, as well as on our present stations. We're picking up another station in Seattle. That means that we're going to be on the air in the same city where we're having the school. And since we're only taking about 12 students, there's a good chance that once we go on the air in Seattle, there'll be a lot of people, you know, locally there who want to go to the school, and it may fill up. So you've got about a week's notice if you would like to enroll before that. I mean, there may be a rush. There may not be. I don't know. We'll just see. But it's certainly, I don't think you can live at home as cheap as you can live at the school. And it's not very many places you can go to get that kind of intensive teaching in so short a time to cover so much. Anyway, information about the school is at the website, thenarrowpath.com. Click on the link that says the new Great Commission School. And as far as the Seattle radio broadcast is concerned, it's going to cost us some money, of course, obviously. It's going to increase our budget quite a bit. We've received several checks that the donors have just put right on the memo. It says for the Seattle station. There's people designating money for the Seattle station. We're going to pick it up in March. We don't mention money very often here, but I just want to let you know that we're stretching a little bit. To add Seattle, we're stretching our finances beyond the comfort zone. And there is a brother who has said he will match all gifts that are designated for the Seattle station up to $1,000 a month for the first 3 months. And so if you want to designate a gift for Seattle, I'm hoping that it won't be coming out of the money that people are already giving to our present stations, because we have to pay those bills too. But if you would like to see us going in Seattle and would like to have somebody match your gift, you can write to us The Narrow Path and put on your check, just designate for the Seattle station if you want to. Information about how to donate we'll give you later in the program before we end. I don't like to spend too much time talking about money, so we're going to go next and talk to Larry from Sterling, Virginia. Hi, Larry. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. How you doing?
All right.
Got a couple of questions about Seventh-day Adventists.
Mm-hmm.
Would you consider them a cult-type group, you know, like a Jehovah's Witness, or would you consider them more sort of orthodox?
Well, they're more orthodox than the Jehovah's Witnesses are and than the Mormons are. And most Christians who talk about cults include the Seventh-day Adventists as orthodox, as an orthodox movement, as opposed to a cult. Although some groups see the Seventh-day Adventists as sort of a borderline cult. Now, the reason this is a difficult thing to answer is because the word cult does not have universally recognized definition. When we think of cults, most Christians think of groups that teach heresies. Severe heresies. Most cult experts would say that if a group denies that Jesus is God, or they deny the Trinity, or they deny justification by faith, that if a group denies those things, those heresies, they would say, constitute them as a cult. By that definition, the Seventh-day Adventists are not a cult. The Seventh-day Adventists believe in the Trinity, they believe in the deity of Christ, they believe in justification by faith. Of course, they believe that we should keep the Sabbath, and they believe that we should, you know, probably be vegetarian or whatever, but they don't believe that those are salvation issues. Not at this point, anyway.
Oh, really? Okay. Because I thought that their sort of view on the Sabbath was not only it was the correct day to worship, but I thought that they linked up the worship of Sunday with the mark of the beast.
They do, but not yet. That's why I said not at this point, anyway. You see, what they believe is this, that the day is coming. Now, I totally disagree with this view, but they believe a day is coming when it will be the government will make it mandatory for people to worship on Sunday. Now, of course, the Seventh-day Adventists are against Sunday as a day of worship. They feel we should be worshiping on Sabbath, which is Saturday. And so they believe that when the time comes that the government requires us to worship on Sunday, that will be the beast. The government will then be intruding into the religious lives of people, and in such a way as to basically persecute those who keep Saturday as a Sabbath.
Okay.
And so they say when that happens, then if you worship on Sunday, you will be taking the mark of the beast.
Okay.
They don't say that you are taking it now, because they're not willing to say that all of us who are not Seventh-day Adventists are, you know, damned. They're not willing to say that. So they don't make Sabbath keeping a salvation issue now, but they do believe the time will come when it will be a salvation issue.
All right. Now, I was looking for a passage to sort of witness to I don't know if witness is the right thing, if a Seventh-day Adventist can be saved, but I was just trying to deal with this issue of the Sabbath. And from my understanding in studying the Sabbath and the scriptures that this particular Seventh-day Adventist gave me, it was my understanding that if you look at the fourth commandment, it didn't really say anything about worship. It just says work and, you know, like what not to do on the Sabbath day. And it was my understanding that the Sabbath really doesn't have anything to do with worship. Am I wrong on that, or where is the scripture that says that you have to worship on the Sabbath day?
The Sabbath law, in various aspects of it, is mentioned many, many times in the Old Testament. When it's mentioned initially in the Ten Commandments, well, actually, even before that, in Exodus 16, it's mentioned when the children of Israel are gathering manna. They're told not to gather manna on the Sabbath, the seventh day. And then, of course, four chapters later, God gives the Ten Commandments. And he says, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. And he goes on to say, in 6 days you shall do your work, but not work on the seventh day. It's clear that these original references to the Sabbath only mention not working. They don't mention worshiping particularly. But as you read through the rest of the Old Testament, you'll find many times, especially in the later books of the law, that there's reference to a command to have a holy convocation on the Sabbath, which is a religious meeting.
Right.
And so even though religious worship is not the central issue of the Sabbath day, but abstaining from work is, there are laws that come that required Israel to have special, you know, religious gatherings on the Sabbath day. Now, the early church, I don't think, observed that. I believe they had their fellowship meetings every day of the week. Mm-hmm. That's what I read in Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4 and 5. We read of them meeting daily in the temple and from house to house. And they sat under the apostles' teaching, and they broke bread and prayed and fellowship together on a daily basis. So I don't think the early church kept one day, as the Seventh-day Adventists want us to, or as the Jews did in the Old Testament, as a holy day. I believe they considered every day to be a holy day, and they tended to have their religious meetings every day of the week.
Right. Yeah, that was the passage that they gave me, was Leviticus 23, where it mentioned a holy convocation.
Yeah.
But that was, as I understood it, it was a feast week, and the Sabbath of a feast week that was to be used as a holy convocation, not on a...
Well, yeah, Leviticus 23 is talking about festival weeks, you're right. But I believe that you'll find as you go through the entire Old Testament, there are references to having a holy convocation on ordinary Sabbaths as well. But you're right, in Leviticus 23 it is talking about the festival weeks, and the first and last days of those weeks were treated as Sabbaths, whether they fell on a Saturday or not, and they were to have holy convocations on those days too.
Okay. Well, I found a scripture in Exodus 16:29,
uh-huh.
And I don't know if it seems to me that this is some instruction, I guess, when they were in the wilderness, but it says that on the seventh day, let every man abide in his place, and let no man go out of his place on the seventh day.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just wondering, then the next verse, so they rested on the seventh day. So I'm wondering, it was when this was initiated at the beginning, were they instructed to just stay at home? Because if they were, then how can you sort of subscribe to the fact that everybody went to worship?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. Obviously, Exodus 23 is pretty early. You've got in Exodus 20, you have the Ten Commandments, and then chapters 21 through 23 give what they usually call the Book of the Covenant, which were rules and statutes that were kind of making application of the Ten Commandments. And so in telling them not to leave their tent or their house on the Sabbath day in chapter 23, it's clear that at least on that original Sabbath day, right after the law was given, they weren't going to have a holy convocation. Now, later passages do mention holy convocations on the Sabbath, but it's interesting because if the very original Sabbath, the first one they kept after the Ten Commandments were given, if it was a day when they were not able to have a holy convocation, but they were supposed to stay in their tents, that raises the issue that clearly the main thing about the Sabbath was not working. The main thing was not about having a holy convocation.
Right, right. See, I was thinking that they may have a point that maybe, I know that the Sabbath obviously fulfills something, you know, sort of a shadow and type and stuff, but maybe we should be keeping the Sabbath in the sense of, you know, honoring a day where we don't work. And maybe they have a point on that, but I certainly couldn't see where there is this prescribed day, which is the seventh day, where we are given to worship, because I didn't see anything that had to do with worship. Also, let me ask you this. Because one of the things they also told me was that it was Jesus' custom to, you know, worship on the Sabbath day. But I thought I heard somewhere that women did not go to the synagogue. Was I correct in hearing that? Or
no, women did go to the synagogue. They had a separate seating arrangement. The men and the women sat in separate sections of the synagogue.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. But as far as that issue, the point before you mentioned women, or what was it you were saying about the synagogue?
I just thought I heard something.
Oh, okay, gotcha. I got off onto the women thing because that was the last thing you mentioned, but I just remembered they said to you that Jesus observed the Sabbath, that he went to, he worshipped on the Sabbath, right?
Right.
Well, Jesus didn't worship one day more than another. God, everything he did, every breath he took, every waking minute, he did what was to glorify his Father. What could be more worshipful than that?
Right.
And so, I mean, sure, Jesus went to the synagogue on the Sabbath, but to say he did so because of some obligation he had would be stretching it, because Jesus actually neglected many of the things that people considered to be the obligations to do on the Sabbath. He healed on the Sabbath, and he did, he seemingly broke the Sabbath on many occasions.
Mm-hmm.
He went to the synagogue on the Sabbath to preach. He didn't go there because, oh, it's my day of worship, so I'm going to go meet and have a day of worship. His day of worship was every day, every moment of every day. He went to the synagogue because that's where there was a crowd that he could preach to. There were other days of the week he preached also. By the way, preaching was his work, and therefore he worked 7 days a week. And that's what he himself said when he was criticized for healing on the Sabbath. In John chapter 5, and verse 17, he said, my Father works all the time, and so do I. In other words, I don't take a day off my work. And what was Jesus' work? Well, like most pastors, he's a preacher, except that most pastors preach once or twice a week. Jesus preached every day of the week. On Sabbath, the reason he went in the synagogue is that's where the people were that he wanted to preach to. They went to the Sabbath, to the synagogue on Sabbath. The other days of the week, he preached to them in the temple or on the hillsides or from a boat on the lake or whatever. You know, he was a preacher. And therefore, in a sense, him preaching on the Sabbath was the opposite of him keeping Sabbath. He did the same kind of work on the Sabbath he did any other day of the week.
Right.
And he pointed out that the priests in the temple did the same thing. And he said the priests in the temple, he said this in Matthew 12, he said on the Sabbath, the priests in the temple, they profane the Sabbath, which means they treat it like a common day. He says, but they're guiltless. Now, what did the priests do on the Sabbath? The same thing they did any other day. That's what was profaning the Sabbath. The word profane doesn't mean you pollute it. It means that you treat it as a common thing. And to the Jew, the Sabbath was not a common day. There were six common days of the week and a sacred day, the Sabbath. But Jesus said this: the priests treat the Sabbath like a common day. Why? Because they do their same work on the Sabbath they do any other day. And that's what Jesus did too. And when it came to his disciples, which is, you know, really the prototype of you and me, the disciples did things on the Sabbath also. And when they were criticized by the Pharisees for it, Jesus defended them. And he said, it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath. And therefore, if his disciples are doing good, they're doing something that's lawful, whether it's even on the Sabbath. Of course, we're supposed to do good every day of the week.
Right.
But it's clear that if what I'm doing is a good thing, then I can do it on the Sabbath as well as any other day of the week. Jesus indicated that the Sabbath for his disciples is not really different than other days. He even said that this way. He said, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath day. And what that seems to mean is this. Jesus is the Lord of Sunday and Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday. He's also the Lord of the Sabbath day, Saturday. He's the Lord of every day. So then how does that translate into the obligation of the disciples? Well, what is the obligation of a disciple? It's to do whatever his Lord wants, to whatever Jesus says. That's what our obligation is any day of the week, including the Sabbath, because he's the Lord also of the Sabbath day. The Sabbath day is not the Lord of us, and it's not the Lord of him. He's the Lord of it, and he's the Lord of us. And therefore, whatever he wants us to do, we should do, whether it's the Sabbath day or any other day of the week.
So then it would be incorrect for Christians to say that the Sabbath was changed.
That is incorrect, yes.
Okay, so the Sabbath is Saturday, always has been Saturday.
That's right.
But Christians just choose to worship collectively on Sunday.
Well, I should put it this way. At some point centuries after Christ, I think it was in the 4th century, one of the popes or one of the leaders, it might have even been Constantine, I'm not sure, actually declared that Sunday was to be treated as was to be the Christian Sabbath. But the Bible doesn't authorize that. As far as the Bible is concerned, Saturday is the Sabbath. And, sometimes when Christians say, well, Sunday is the Sabbath now, what they say is, well, Jesus rose from the dead on the Sabbath day, or, excuse me, on Sunday, the first day of the week. And therefore, Christians have called the first day of the week the Lord's Day, and it has become the Christian Sabbath. But that's not quite true. It is probably true that Jesus rose on Sunday, although we don't know. His tomb was found to be empty around dawn on Sunday. He might have, it's not an issue when he rose. But the point here is, we don't ever find any mention in Scripture of the disciples saying, well, since Jesus rose on this day, that's going to be our regular day of worship. Now, that is the way Christians thought in a later generation, but not in New Testament times. And in the book of Acts, of course, the entire book of Acts records the behavior of the disciples after the resurrection of Jesus, at such a time as one would think they had changed the Sabbath to Sunday because of the resurrection of Jesus. But in the book of Acts, we never find them referring to Sunday as the Sabbath, but we do find in the book of Acts many references to the Sabbath. But it's always the Jewish Sabbath. There's no indication in the Old or New Testament that there's a special Christian Sabbath that's a different day of the week than the Jewish Sabbath.
So we almost create the argument for them by declaring that the Sabbath was changed.
You got it.
When in fact it wasn't.
You got it. We put ourselves in a very weak position vis-a-vis the Sabbath keepers if we say, well, yes, we have to keep the Sabbath, but now Sunday's the Sabbath. Well, we have absolutely, absolutely no scriptural basis for saying any such thing as that. But if we say, well, the Sabbath was, God said it was a sign of the old covenant that he made with Israel, and it's something that Jesus never instructed his disciples to do, and that Jesus said that he's the Lord of every day, including the Sabbath, and that it's lawful to do good on the Sabbath, which is, of course, also the only thing it's ever lawful to do any day. Jesus made it clear that for his disciples, the Sabbath is like any other day. So Paul, in Romans 14, talks about how in the church in Rome, there were different opinions about such things among the Christians. He said, one man esteems one day above another. Another man esteems every day alike. And then he says, let every man be fully persuaded in his own mind. So he's saying there are some Sabbath keepers in the Church of Rome, probably the Jewish Christians, because they had kept Sabbath all their life. They probably tended to continue that practice. But he said other Christians were just keeping every day alike. That means they didn't keep a special day.
Right.
And Paul said, well, do whatever you feel comfortable doing, whatever your conscience approves of. In other words, Paul's saying there's no particular rule about this that all Christians have to conform to.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's another way that Paul was saying, we don't have to keep a Sabbath special. We can keep every day alike if we're going to keep every day unto the Lord.
Right. Okay, fantastic, Steve. Appreciate your answer.
Okay, Larry, good talking to you.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye. Thanks for your call. Bye now. I want to remind you that we have a Monday night meeting in Salinas each Monday night, including tonight at 7 o'clock. Information about that can be found at the website. We also have the Great Commission School in Seattle coming up, 10-week live-in intensive course with yours truly, teaching through quite a big chunk of the Old Testament and part of the New Testament with a group of students that will live in, eat, and survive and spend all day in classes there for 10 weeks intensive training. That's in Seattle this summer. And also we're going to be going on the air in Seattle March 1st. And we appreciate anyone who may feel so inclined who'd like to designate some gifts to pay for the Seattle station to consider doing so. All of those things I just want to leave with you before we close. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can find that address. You can find a link about the Great Commission School. You can find many resources free to you. And you can find information about where I'm speaking, all at our website. That website is www.thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow, and we'll continue our discussion.